Other side.
Oh, I know.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Joint Interim Committee on Transportation and Preservation and Modernization this fine September 22nd, 2016. I was just handed a document by Mr. Maxey, which I think I will read. I think it's quite fascinating. The first committee meeting that we had for the Joint Transportation Committee began in May during legislative days. And if you use Salem as a starting and ending point, we've logged more than 2,100 miles this summer as we've traveled around the state listening to the local area commissions on transportation and local residents and communities from Salem to East Portland to Ontario, Hermiston, Redmond, Medford, Eugene, Newport. We're here tonight. We were in Hillsboro on Monday, and we will have one final meeting in Albany, Corvallis area on October the 24th. So we've had a wonderful summer traveling around listening to citizens and people who work in transportation about what their issues are and how important this package is to them. So we've learned a great deal, and I appreciate all of the people that have attended across the state. And on that note, tonight we have an informational hearing for 1 hour from the Oregon Department of Transportation helping to educate the committee. Mr. Travis Brower and Mr. Paul Mather will be joining us, and then we will open our public hearing at 6 o'clock. So I would like to begin by inviting Mr. Brower and Mr. Mather to the dais. So thank you, gentlemen, for being here this evening. Committee, we have a very finite time frame tonight, and Senator Courtney, thank you for joining us this evening. So what I might suggest in the expedition, and we're trying to keep the time short on this presentation so we have plenty of time for our public hearing that begins at 6. If you have questions from this presentation, rather than ask them during the meeting, if you wouldn't mind jotting them down, we will present them to Mr. Mather and Mr. Brower, and they will come back with answers to us at a future date so we can make sure that we have time for our public testimony this evening. Okay. Gentlemen, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Travis Brower, the Assistant Director of ODOT, and I have to apologize at the beginning for this nagging cold and cough I've got. It's actually going to be good for you because it will encourage me to say less, and good for me because if you ask any questions I can't answer, I'll just engage in a coughing fit. So hopefully that'll keep us on track. I was asked today to give you a funding overview of how Oregon funds the transportation system. So I'm going to go through this at a fairly high clip, not at a great level of detail. There'll be plenty of time, hopefully, for you to answer questions tonight and in the future for us to dig into some of these topics. For some of you, this will be old hat. For others, this may be a little bit new. So I'm going to try to keep it at a fairly high level. I'm going to start by talking to you about the major funding sources we receive in the state of Oregon and how we use them on the surface transportation system. So the first area of transportation funding I'd like to talk about is the federal government's provision of funds to the state of Oregon. Each year, Oregon receives about $600 million in federal formula funds from the Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Transit Administration, as well as some additional discretionary grants on top of that. Most of that money from the formula grants comes from the federal gas tax, which is 18.4 cents per gallon, has been 18.4 cents per gallon since 1993. That's put into the Highway Trust Fund and then flows down to the states and local governments.
You tried to get me.
A lot of money, though, in addition to the gas tax, is now being placed in the Highway Trust Fund from the general fund because that has not been increased in recent years.
That's what I said.
So let's start talking about the federal highway funding. Each year, ODOT receives about $500 million, about $500 million in federal highway funding. That was flat or declining for years. Between 2010 and 2015, we actually lost significant ground even before accounting for inflation. Then, in the end of 2015, Congress passed the FAST Act, which provides a slight increase in funding. Very exciting when you get a slight increase in funding after years of declines. So what we see is that for the next 4 years through 2020, we have certainty around the amount of funding that's coming to Oregon, and we get a slight increase. So two cheers for the FAST Act. The nice thing about the federal funding that comes to the state is it's essentially a formula block grant, that all that money flows through ODOT and then flows out to local governments as well in some cases. So the state and local governments are able to select projects so long as they're eligible. We have to follow all the federal processes, however. And there's a lot of strings attached, federal environmental rules, procurement rules, design rules, et cetera. Sometimes you'll hear about complaints that help increase the cost of projects. As I mentioned, a lot of that money ends up flowing to local governments. About a third of the federal highway funding that ODOT receives then flows out to local governments under a number of programs. One of the largest is the Surface Transportation Program, which provides, by federal formula, a block of grants to the large urban areas in Oregon, Salem-Keizer, Eugene, Springfield, and the Portland metro region. And then through an agreement between ODOT, cities, and counties, provides money to all 36 counties as well as all the cities that are with a population of 5,000 or more. There's also an enhanced discretionary program that is included in our statewide transportation improvement program, or STIP. There's a local bridge program that provides funding for local bridge repairs. We, in recent years, have started sharing more safety money with local governments because a significant portion of the fatalities and serious injuries are on local roads. So we want that money to flow to the most important, highest priority safety projects. So local governments get about half of that safety funding through the All Roads Transportation Safety Program. There's also a program called CMAQ, Congestion Mitigation Air Quality Improvement, that funds projects in a small number of eligible areas that have air quality challenges. That includes the Portland metro region, as well as the Rogue Valley, Klamath Falls, Lakeview, and Oak Ridge, as well as now Salem-Keizer and Eugene-Springfield have been added by decision of the Federal Highway Administration this year. There's also a federal lands access program that provides an additional allocation of funds that ODOT and local governments share for projects on any road that provides access to or is on federal highway or federal lands. So in Oregon, we get one of the largest allocations of any state in the nation under that program. As I said, about a third of the funding flows to local governments. That's actually increased under the FAST Act. Local governments are receiving more, a larger share of the funding from the federal government. That's largely because the larger urban areas in the state are now receiving a larger amount of money under the formula set by Congress. There's also an allocation of federal transit funding that comes to Oregon. Each year, Oregon gets about $100 million in formula grants, and then we've been successful, particularly in the Lane County area and in the Portland metro region, in also securing significant federal grants for building out light rail and bus rapid transit. But each year, we get a base of about $100 million that comes to the state in formula grants, primarily to urban areas, which, as you can imagine, most of the transit is in urban areas. And so, for example, the Portland metro region gets a little over half the money, and then the other urban areas get funding as well. That money goes directly from the Federal Transit Administration to those urban areas. ODOT receives the funding for rural areas and distributes that to some of those smaller town transit services, anything in an area under 50,000. Let me shift now to the State Highway Fund. There's a pretty important distinction in recent years between how we use our federal funds versus how we use our state highway funds. Federal funds have to be used for capital expenditures, and so we take all those federal funds, we put it into our statewide transportation improvement program, and they're used for projects. State Highway Fund, though, is at this point largely used for basic day-to-day maintenance. So that's picking up dead deer, fixing potholes, plowing snow, etc. It is also now, to a significant extent, used for debt service, which I'll show you a little bit later in the presentation, as well as for the agency operations. A relatively little amount is left after those needs are met for using for capital programs in the STIP, other than, of course, the JTA projects, the Job and Transportation Act projects that are currently under construction, although most of those are now complete. So it is essentially fully committed to those debt service, maintenance, and agency operations. One of the key features of the State Highway Fund is that it is dedicated by the Oregon Constitution, Article 9, Section 3. Any revenue from motor fuels, as well as any revenue from the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles, is automatically placed into the State Highway Fund and can only be used for highway projects and uses, which includes bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure that is located within the highway right-of-way. The State Highway Fund in Oregon, we have a very well-balanced revenue portfolio. We have three major sources of funds. The first and largest is the motor fuels tax, which is just a little under half, 44% in the last state fiscal year, about $530 million a year in total. Then we also have DMV fees, which would largely be title and registration and driver licenses, that account for about $336 million, or 28%. The third area is the motor carrier taxes and fees. This is largely the weight mile tax as well as truck registration fees. That under the Oregon Constitution, we have a requirement for cost responsibility between heavy and light vehicles. So as a result, when those amounts that passenger vehicles are increased, those amounts that the trucking industry pay are adjusted upward to account for the disproportionate wear and tear that large trucks have on the transportation system. So again, a very well-balanced revenue portfolio with a variety of sources. Now, in terms of how that money goes out the door, there are a number of things that come off the top of the State Highway Fund. For example, there are the cost of collections, the cost of collecting money at the DMV, the cost of administering the fuel tax program. That comes off the top, as does a number of transfers that go out to other agencies. For example, recreational vehicle registration fees go to state parks under the Constitution. Motor fuel taxes that are used by boats go to the Marine Board, etc. So after taking those things out and then covering debt service, the State Highway Fund is apportioned by formulas in state law. There's actually a number of them. What it amounts to, though, generally, is after taking these things out, ODOT gets about half, and then counties get about 30%, and cities get about 20%. So it is a very even split between the state and local governments in terms of how that money goes out the door. In terms of how that money is distributed among counties and cities, as I said, 30% of the State Highway Fund, and particularly 30% of any new revenue that is raised, typically goes to counties. That in 15-16 amounted to $243 million in that year. It's distributed among the 36 counties based on the number of vehicles registered in the county. So as you can see, that leads to some significant differentials in what each county gets. $41.4 million from Multnomah County, about $140,000 for Wheeler County. Because this is not based in any measure of need or road mileage or anything like that, just on the number of motor vehicles. There are a program for small counties that does help address some of those differentials that does provide a little bit money to the small counties, but it's a very small amount. Cities are similar. They receive about 20% of the State Highway Fund, and 20% of any new revenue typically goes there. For about $164 million, that's distributed among over 200 cities based on population. So, for example, the little town of Lone Rock receives $1,186 last year. The city of Portland receives a little bit more than that.
District. And we appreciate the $1,000.
You take the $36
million. There is, as for the counties, there is a small cities program that comes, that is half the funding provided by ODOT, half the funding provided by cities, that then is distributed in grants for small cities to ensure that they have at least some funding opportunities available to them. The third major category of funds after state federal funds and then the State Highway Fund is the Connect Oregon program of lottery-backed bonds. This was created by the legislature in 2005 and since then has provided $427 million in lottery-backed bonds that funds non-highway infrastructure, transit, rail, marine infrastructure, aviation, as well as bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure that was added back in 2013, that is focused on integrating the modes and improving the efficient flow of goods and people. So that has been a very important funding source in recent years for those non-highway modes that otherwise cannot receive any of the funding from the State Highway Fund. When you look at these three funding sources, what you see is that between the three of them, we're able to cover all the modes of transportation, but some of them we have a much more difficult time. So, for example, highways and bicycle pedestrian are relatively easy to fund out of federal and state funds. There are more limited opportunities for rail, ports, and aviation. And in particularly, we find transit operations and rail operations are where there is oftentimes a big hole in the funding that is available from these various sources. So none of them are necessarily adequate, but we at least do have opportunities to fund different types of projects. There are a number of other miscellaneous revenue sources that I thought I would just mention. Most of these flow to non-highway purposes because they're not subject to the constitutional dedication. Custom license plates, because you're paying a surcharge, that goes into the passenger rail program. The Transportation Operations Fund, we affectionately call that the lawnmower fund, because if you fill up your lawnmower with gas, you're technically using it off-road. Well, I hope you're using it off-road. You're entitled to a refund on that gas tax you paid, but very few people fill out that paperwork. So that money then flows into this Transportation Operations Fund, largely used for passenger rail and as well as for senior and disabled transit. Identification cards, again, that goes to senior and disabled transit. A small amount of the cigarette tax, about $6.6 million, this biennium goes into senior and disabled transportation. And there's also a little bit of general fund money. I thought I'd also mention that there are a number of local resources for transportation, although local governments do depend in Oregon fairly heavily on the federal transportation funding and the state highway fund for roads. There are also 26 cities and two counties that levy a local gas tax, and we're seeing that number increase recently. Street utility fees are often used as an add-on to utility bills that the cities send out to increase transportation funding. Some cities use a portion of their property tax for transportation. Multnomah County has a vehicle registration fee that's paying for the Selwood Bridge or a portion of the Selwood Bridge. And then oftentimes, cities in particular will use system development charges for paying for the cost of growth that new housing and other infrastructure imposes on the system. So that was the whirlwind tour through how we fund transportation. Now I'll walk you through pretty quickly about some of the trends and issues we see in these funding sources. This is our famous mountain chart, which shows you the construction programs that ODOT has, including the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or STIP, as well as the OTIAs, the Jobs and Transportation Act, the Recovery Act, and the Connect Oregon Program. As you can see, we've come over the tall part of the mountain, and we're sort of now on the downward coast down that hill. By 2021, we're actually going to be at a lower level in terms of just absolute dollars, not even accounting for inflation, than we were back in 2001 before the legislature passed the OTIA program. So a lot of people wonder how that is, and there's really a number of factors and trends and issues that we're dealing with right now. Let me walk you through some of those. The first off is simply that a lot of these one-time programs are coming to an end. We've completed the OTIA program, and the Jobs and Transportation Act program is now largely behind us. We have a number of programs still out there. There's also a lot of uncertainty around federal funding in the long term, and I'll walk you through that as well. Our debt service obligations that have been issued as a result of these many of the funding packages in recent years continue out for the next couple of decades, so that will limit the funding we have in free cash for new projects. We also see that construction cost increases have really eroded the purchasing power of our revenue streams due to inflation. A recent trend that we're seeing is fuel efficiency is increasing. And then as I've sort of gestured toward, non-highway funding generally, particularly from the state level, is fairly minimal, so it's not adequate in a lot of cases to cover some of the needs that are out there. So let me walk you through those. As I mentioned, federal funding is uncertain. The FAST Act goes through 2020, so near to the end of our current, the statewide transportation improvement program we're working through. But in 2021, it goes negative. The reason is that the federal gas tax has not been raised since 1993, and so its revenue has been flat or declining for years. In order to keep funding at a high level, as you can see in this chart, expenditures are well above the revenues and interest. That means that the Congress has had to shovel a significant amount of money into the Highway Trust Fund from the general fund. And since a number of our leading transportation officials have said it, including Congressman DeFazio, to a significant extent there were budget gimmicks used to transfer that money to the Highway Trust Fund. In 2021, that cash runs out, and all of a sudden we're faced with a major hole of about a third. So if Congress does nothing in 2021 to provide additional revenue, we'll see our federal transportation funding fall by about a third. As you can imagine, since in the transportation world we work on 5-10 year development cycles, that makes it really hard to plan for the long term. The other challenge we've seen in recent years is really is debt service increasing to fund many of our important programs. Now, you know, in 2001 we were largely a pay-as-you-go state, but we've moved to more toward a debt financing model. There's nothing wrong with that. Most of us in this room probably have or have had a mortgage at some point. Bonding is a lot like a mortgage. You take out a mortgage in order to buy a house a lot faster than you could if you had to pay cash up front. In this case, we took out a mortgage essentially through bonding to buy a lot more highway projects than we would have been able to if we just did them on a cash flow basis. So over the last decade, or over the last 15 years, we've built a lot of highway projects, a lot of really important projects, a lot of other projects as well. And we've gotten good value out of that. We've had very low interest rates, and our debt at ODOT, we have a very prudent rating or very prudent debt management program. We have only about a third of our revenues are dedicated toward debt service, and that's a good revenue. We wouldn't recommend going a lot above that because that has allowed us to have good interest rates. We have a AAA rating from one bond rating agency and generally are able to get a very good deal on this debt. But what it means is that, as you can see, we have a lot of money going out the door toward debt service over the next couple of decades that isn't available for new projects. It's just paying for the projects that are already done. Another major factor is that the transportation fees and taxes are not in any way adjusted for inflation. So with most taxes, that property taxes rise as property values go up, income taxes increase, or total collections increase as incomes go up, sales taxes with prices, etc. Gas taxes, vehicle registration fees are set at a flat level. And so over time, they're eaten away by inflation. We looked at what the federal gas tax would have to be today to have the same purchasing power, just in absolute terms of the consumer price index. So in 1993, it was 18.4 cents per gallon. Today, to have that same purchasing power, it would have to be over 30 cents a gallon. The same with the state gas tax. Even though the legislature raised that in 2009 in the JTA, it has not kept pace with inflation since 1993. To have that same purchasing power today, it would have to be about 40 cents per gallon as opposed to the 30 cents it is today. We put that into infographic form to help people understand this, in part because we don't just face the consumer price index at ODOT. We actually face price increases that are higher because we buy construction commodities, which have seen very rapid increases. So everybody knows that household good prices go up. You can buy a lot less of bread or coffee or milk for the same amount of money in 2014 than you could in 1993, the last time the federal gas tax was raised. Well, it's the same thing for our construction commodities, except worse. So for the amount we paid for 2,000 pounds of rebar today in 93, we can only buy 900 pounds today. 10 yards of concrete. Yards of concrete in 1993, we can only buy 5 yards today. 10 tons of asphalt in 1993, we can only buy 3.5 tons today. That means that in all those cases, the price of those commodities have at least doubled, and in the case of asphalt, about tripled. What that means is that for every mile of road we could build for a given amount in 1993, we can build half as much today, which is obviously a significant challenge for us. In the last couple of years, we've also seen, we've had sort of one whammy in terms of the inflation. Now we have the double whammy of fuel efficiency increasing. For years, fuel efficiency stayed about the same. But then in 2009, the federal government imposed new corporate average fuel economy standards that are increasing the fuel efficiency of the fleet significantly. In the last few years, since 2008, fuel efficiency of the entire Oregon fleet increased by about 7.5%. Last year alone, it was 1.5%. We're seeing that expected into the future for the foreseeable future. What that means is that the number of gallons of gasoline used by the vehicle fleet is going to peak in a couple of years and then begin a long, inexorable decline. Now, that's good for the consumers. That's good for the environment. But it's not so good when your main funding source, that's about half of your state funding and most of your federal funding, is based on how many gallons of gasoline you sell. So this is going to be a major challenge as we look to the future and our fuels tax revenue starts to decline and continues to decline going into the future. What was really interesting, when we took a look at what this means overall, when you factor in inflation and fuel efficiency and all the other factors here, what we're seeing is there's really sort of a double whammy. That means the amount that people, the amount that Oregonians contribute to the state highway fund is actually falling over time, unless and until the legislature increases the any of the taxes and fees. So our economists calculated that in 1971, the average Oregonian per capita paid $52.70 into the state highway fund in 1971 dollars. In 2016, the average Oregonian on a per capita basis will pay $42.80. So that's essentially close to a 20% tax cut in terms of what your bill to the state highway fund is over that period of time. Now, one of the reasons for this is that compared to many Western states, Oregon actually has relatively low automobile-related taxes. That's not to say our gas tax is particularly low, because it is right in the middle of the pack among the Western states, 30 cents per gallon. Most of the other Western states are somewhere in that range. What we have in Oregon, though, is the lowest driver and motor vehicle fees of any state in the nation. When you buy a motor vehicle in Oregon, you pay for a title for $77, and registration is $43 a year, so $120 for your first year of ownership. Most states, you pay a sales tax or an ad valorem tax or some sort of tax, a registration fee sometimes based on size or weight. Most of those are much lower. So even our combined license or title and registration are literally the lowest of any state in the nation. So with that, I will wrap up my presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Mather, welcome.
Write them down and we'll do them later.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm going to try to move through the life cycle of a project from its inception to our completion of the project and give you some of the high points of how a project proceeds. As you've been on your tour and I've been on the tour with you, you've seen various stages of these projects as people have talked to you about projects they want, projects that are in design, projects you've seen in construction. So I'm going to try to connect those dots for you tonight to show you how things are put together. So this is that project life cycle that I'm talking about. Talk about policy and needs and selection and so forth as we go through. Projects, we start with policy, planning, and sometimes statute. As you put projects into statute, whether it's with JTA or whether with a capital construction program, but traditionally they start in the policy planning arena. From ODOT standpoint and the commission standpoint, we have the Oregon Transportation Plan, and the Oregon Transportation Plan sets out policies, and then we have our promoter plans. On the local government side, which is the land use agencies, they have their comp plans, and they have then their transportation system plans that bring those things together from a state level and a local level and knit those together where projects are identified in those transportation system plans. And that's really the birthplace for the majority of our enhance or modernization projects. Not on the fix-it pavement bridge, I'll get to that here shortly, but that's where you see many of the projects that you see on the tour, that's where they've originated from. The next step in the process is we talk about funding. So Travis just went through and talked about where we are funding-wise, but we put the financial constraints lens over those projects that have been identified through the planning process. Again, legislatively, you've passed bills such as the Jobs and Transportation Act, which puts projects into statutes and fund those projects. But the federal funds that Travis was just talking about, our Transportation Commission goes through a process to select projects in two major categories that we talk about. Enhance, you'll hear us talk about enhance projects. Those are projects that expand the system. They're additional lanes, additional interchanges, or what we call fix-it projects, and those are just taking care of what we have, pavements, bridges, those types of things. In our transportation plan, it specifies that we need to take care of what we have first before we expand, and it's illustrated here in the dollar amounts in our commission's actions to put as much money as they can really towards fix-it. This amount that we have in fix-it doesn't take care of entirely of our asset. When I'm in front of you in the future, I'll be talking about our bridge needs and pavement needs. This does not fully fund that, but they do recognize we have to spend some money on the enhanced side just to provide some operational improvements and enhancement to the system. The selection process. So enhanced process, if you met with the various area commissions of transportation around the state, they're very involved in that process. As you've heard them talk about their needs and their involvement in selecting those projects, they are directly created by the Transportation Commission. They're chartered by them, and they report their results and recommendations back to the Commission through our enhanced process. On the fix-it side, we use our asset management systems. Travis talked a little bit about the All-Road Safety Program, but it's really a data-driven process for our safety programs. We're aimed at those areas with fatal and serious accidents, both from a reactive and a proactive standpoint. So we target those areas where we have high crash rates, but we also apply things like cable barriers, rumble strips, other things in a proactive way to prevent those things from happening in the first place. We have a pavement management system that tries to target when a pavement is going through its decline or its failure. We try to pick those points in its life where we can add a chip seal, we can add an overlay before we get to a very costly total rebuild of the project. Our bridge inventory, local bridge culverts, operations is really kind of a catch-all. We put rock falls in there, we put signal enhancements in there, illumination. There's a variety of things that go in our operation category. All those things are folded together into our STIP that Travis talked about. It's our capital improvement program. Our commission there is the one that approves that. It's a federal document. It includes all federal funds have to be in there, and we also include our major state projects are also included in that document. Once we have an approved STIP, we really go into some intense project management, program management processes that we have in the department. Each project has a project charter, and in that charter, we document coming out of that selection process. We have a scope, it has a schedule, and it has a budget. We make sure that if it's a pavement project, it stays a pavement project and doesn't expand into a new interchange or a new lane or so forth. We have a schedule for that project, and we have, obviously, a budget for that project. We have a change management process because we know life change, life happens, that we get public input and we discover things as we go through the design process. But it's a conscious decision. If we're going to add scope, change schedule, change budget, we've got to go back and understand the impacts that may have to another project on the list that may suffer the consequences of that. And we may have to go back to our commission and so forth to make those adjustments to the STIP. The next thing we think about is several different things. One is just the size of the project and how we approach it, the type of contracting that we're going to use on the project. So first I'll talk about size. So we try to do a couple of things. One is we try to size projects small enough that we can get new contractors into the business, that we continue to develop new contractors to make sure we have a stable of contractors here in Oregon that keeps competition high. And keeps that contracting environment healthy. We also try to phase projects in a way that we can size projects for Oregon firms to be highly competitive. As you've gone around and seen various projects around, you've seen evidence of this, where we try to hit that sweet spot of about $40 to $80 million we have found keeps Oregon firms very competitive in that market. It helps us from a competitive standpoint and obviously helps the economy of Oregon by keeping those Oregon firms involved in projects. At this point, we also talk about the type of contracting that we want to use. Our traditional way is what we call design bid build, where a design is done either in-house or by a consultant. We bid those projects out based on low bids, select a contractor, and build the project. That's our traditional way, but even in that methodology, we have some flexibility. I was in the Senate this morning, briefing the Senate committee on a project that we have outside of Sweetholm on Highway 20, what we call Sheep Creek Bridge. We actually put incentives, disincentives into that contract where the contractor had a $14,000 a day bonus or a $14,000 a day penalty if they went before or after that. So in this case, the contractor finished the contract while this construction was the contractor. They finished 2 weeks early and got almost a $200,000 bonus for completing that project and opening that road. We had the road closed while that work was going on early. We also look at other contracting methods. Design build is one where we go out and do a solicitation through a best value. It's not a low bid process. It's a best value where a team of a construction contractor and a design firm team up and give proposals to us, which we evaluate based on best value. CMGC is a process we used on the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene where we stay kind of in that middle of that relationship. We go ahead and we hire a design firm and a contractor together, but we have the contractor contract with the design firm, and we have the contract with the contractor, and we stay, as an owner, we stay in the middle of that relationship to help guide more risky projects such as the project in Eugene. We've explored public-private partnerships. It's another method, but we have not used in Oregon. We've explored three or four projects, but we haven't found a project that pencils out with that, but that's another tool that's available to us. On the design side, today we do about half of the work in-house in ODOT, and we do about half of the work through consultants. That number varies and has varied over the last decade to as much as 30% outsourced, as to as high as 70% outsourced. And I would tell you that's the range we probably should be in. If we go lower than that and we have ODOT staff, say, doing 100% of the work, I think I would say that that puts us in too risky of a place, and vice versa, that if we go to almost all outsourced, we need to keep some technical competency as an owner to understand bridges, understand pavements, to be able to manage consultants doing that same work. So anywhere in that 30 to 70% range, we've been over the last decade, and I think proven we can be successful. Just as a rule of thumb for you, as we talk about how much staff we need to deliver projects, about for every $1 million in program volume that we talk about, we need about two positions to deliver that, both in the design and the construction phase of that. The next phase we go into is what we call preliminary design. And this is really, really where we outreach to the public to really understand now that we have a concept of a project. We really pull out to the communities for to get their engagement. And some of our complex projects, we'll do what we call design charrettes, and we'll involve them in exploring different interchanges and different designs of that. It's really, at this point, kind of a pay me now or pay me later. I've been doing this for a long time, and I can't tell you how many times where we've skipped or skimped on this step and found later on as we got under contract or under permit for a project that we paid the consequences of not involving the public. So we've learned this lesson in many hard ways, but it's an important step, especially here in Oregon, which has a high value for public involvement, that we reach out to them and involve them in the process. This stage can take a while to go through, depends on your project. If you're talking about a project such as the Sunrise Corridor or Newburgh-Dundee, it can take a long time to get through this process. There are also we get to this phase, it's almost a chicken and egg sometimes that we get into in these complex projects, and then we don't really understand the cost until we involve the public and really understand what this project is going to look like so we can assign a cost to it. So there'll be projects that kind of sit in this piece as we understand the project before we actually go apply either here or to our commission for funding. I would tell you when we were in the 09 session and talking about the Jobs and Transportation Act, we had a lot of projects kind of idling in this stage in our process. Those projects that you've seen on Highway 62, Newburgh-Dundee, Sunrise Corridor, all those projects were idling, kind of waiting for funding. Woodburn Interchange was another example, waiting for funding. Today, we don't have a lot of projects in here. We have a few projects in here, but not like we had in 09 because of the financial situation that Travis was laying out to you. We have put more of our resources, or our commission has put more of our resources into the fix-it side of our program and other projects. Once we have what we call the design acceptance package, that's about that 30% design, or we've done that preliminary engineering work, we now have a footprint of a project and we can move into final design. The critical path here is typically right away. We need to know enough about the project that we can establish lines on people's property, go out to them and negotiate with them the purchase of their property and final design. In this stage, we've kind of moved out of that creative public process, and we've really moved into more of a production mode and moving now as rapidly as we can from that design acceptance package to a contract and get a contractor moving forward. As we kind of exit this process, there are several things that we work on, various permits that we need, whether they're environmental permits, land use permits. Often we do a constructability review where we bring in several contractors that come in and help us understand how we're going to stage this project or how are we going to approach this project to make sure it's as buildable or constructible as possible. We look at mobility constraints or concerns. We have many commitments out there that we've made to minimize delays, to allow over-dimensional loads through our project. There's also commitments we've made in kind of paired routes for these over-dimensional loads to make sure that we've accommodated all our mobility commitments. Work zone strategies. We're committed to having a safe work zone for motorists and workers and trying to provide a positive barrier between traffic and workers as if at all possible. DBE goals are set in this stage. And typically, the first thing you'll see on a project is when utilities are out there starting to move the various utilities. Again, a critical path for us to get that information to the various utilities so they can do their work before we let our contract. We then move into construction administration of the project. We continue to do outreach with the community. Obviously, our projects have, in many cases, a significant impact on driveways, people's properties, and people's daily lives as they commute. And so we need to continue to communicate with them, listen to them and their concerns, adjust our projects, and so forth. One of the things I'd like to point out in this slide, if you look at the construction equipment there, you'll see the automated features that it has on it. Those receptacles that you see on the either end of the blade of that bulldozer is taking information from the satellite and designing that project. There are no stakes, as you see in the picture, or stakes in that project. It's part of the technology that we now see in our construction world. The two inspectors that you see out there from the ODOT standpoint, you notice they have tablets in their hands. We're rapidly moving to a paperless environment where we can do all the documentation that we need to do on the project in real time. And have electronic file cabinets and so forth. One of the examples of how this helps from an efficiency standpoint is we're able to process a change order on a contract, not in a matter of weeks, but in a matter of days. That time means money to contractors and to our staffs and able to keep things moving. Just this overall automation, we've seen an increase or a decrease in costs of 4 to 6% of our projects, and probably as or more importantly, we've seen construction time reduced by 20 or 30%. One of the things I just want to touch on in here, there's been some an article in the media talking or questioning about our processes that we use for quality control on our projects. I will point out. In that article, it does raise questions about the processes that we use. It doesn't raise questions about our projects, that there is actual material concerns that we have. In fact, we continue to compare very favorably with other states when you look at things like smoothness of pavements with other states neighboring us or around the country. But we've taken those things seriously. We've asked Federal Highway Administration to follow up on their investigation or an audit that they do of us periodically. We've asked them to accelerate their next review of our practices that we have, and they will be doing that. We will be using automation as well. We've made a decision to, starting next summer, is to require on our major paving projects that we use automated compaction. That on the rollers you see behind the pavers, there'll be data receptacles that will not only ensure that we have the density of pavements, but also we have the roller patterns or the compaction from the rollers behind the pavement. We'll have in that real data that will be collected that will be able to document whether that contractor has done what they were supposed to do in our specifications. Madam Chair, I plan to follow up you on this topic later. It's a matter of time that I want to stay on schedule, but
that
this is an important topic for us, and
great.
I will share a letter with you later that goes into more detail what we plan to do to follow up with some of those concerns.
Great. Thank you.
So the next stage, obviously, we get to celebrate a project and opening that project and cut a ribbon on that project. I don't want us to forget that we're not done with that at that point. We still have to maintain and operate that. There's a big part of ODOT's budget, as you saw, that Travis was talking about, that takes just to maintain and operate our system. Just in closing, I just want to run through a couple examples for you so you can kind of see what I've just outlined from a process standpoint, what that may look like in a project. So the Woodburn Interchange, I referred to that several times, is about an $80 million project. That cost includes the right-of-way, the construction. That's the complete cost of that project. Obviously, it's a major involvement from a public standpoint. It was in that, you know, preliminary design stage, I say plus or minus 5 years. It's hard to actually draw that line of when we started into that because, again, we were waiting for that funding to really get some of the details around what the preliminary design of that project would look like. Right away took a considerable amount of time on this project. We had a number of files. We were touching gas stations, hazmat issues, other things that we needed to work through on the final design and right away. And then construction. We planned on construction taking 3 years on this project. The contractor was able to do it in 2 years. Another example project in Eastern Oregon, this is a preservation project or a pavement project that we had just outside of La Grande. We had on the interstate on 84, we had this plan, had this in the queue. Legislature passed, you passed the Jobs and Transportation Act, which included a climbing lane in the section. So we're able to marry up here an enhanced project and a fix of projects that have some efficiencies. But even in this project, we had some public outreach we needed to do. This had major impacts for trucks, over-dimensional trucks that go in through this corridor. We essentially restricted, as we were doing the concrete pavement work, we restricted over-dimensional loads. So now loads, for example, that were originating out of Portland had to go up over Mount Hood, through Redmond, Highway 20, onto Ontario. We needed to coordinate that, live up to our commitments to make sure that route was open for those over-dimensional loads as we did work. We're also constrained, obviously, by snow and weather in this environment that we're only able to work during the summer months and doing that pavement and that earthwork, which really led to why the construction took 3 years to 3 years on this project. Another example, Ross Island Bridge project that's going underway now, a $40 million project to repaint that bridge. We had some public involvement. We actually had some conversations about what color to paint the bridge. It's something that's an important issue to a lot of people, and we know we need to have that conversation with them. We ended up painting it the same color that it is today, but we had that conversation with them. We have some preliminary design, some final design moves through those stages very rapidly. But construction takes a while. This is a very labor-intensive, expensive process that will take 2 or 3 years to go through and repaint that bridge. Another smaller scale project, this is a safety project on Highway 34. We were putting a median barrier down. This was actually funded in the capital construction budget the legislature passed last session to put barrier on Highway 34. We've had some head-on collisions in this corridor. Some public involvement just because we're affecting accesses, even farm access. I know Representative Olson and I have had conversations on this. But it moves through that process, again, relatively quickly. Construction happens relatively quickly on a project of that size and scale. Culverts, those of you that are in Newport heard me and Vivian talk about our needs on culverts, another example of a culvert project. Again, minor involvement from the public, moves through the process fairly quickly. The permitting process takes the longest time here. And then construction, we're limited by in-water work periods, typically is the one we can be doing the work. So I end with this chart to kind of give you that array of a project. There's not really a typical project. They all have different dimensions to them, but they all kind of go through those same phases that I tried to describe here that has a preliminary design phase, a final design phase, and through a construction phase. So hopefully that gives you some grounding as you go out and touch projects or see projects of what the process is and how a project was created, how it goes through the process, and where we end up at ribbon cutting.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Committee, we are about 10 minutes ahead of schedule. We have two options. We could ask a couple of questions, if you would like, or we could move through to, we have two colleagues who would like to present to us today. Representative Benson, Representative Taylor would like to join us, or we could move into our public hearing. Do we have a couple of very short questions? Senator Johnson.
I have a question. In the early part of Travis's presentation, that was a very succinct and good presentation, Travis. You talk about all of the pass-through money and the various small grant projects and what federal money goes to what jurisdictions. My curiosity is how much discretion does ODOT have over the projects that are selected at the local level? And how cumbersome is the grant process? Are you guys picking those projects that you want? How heavy is your thumb on local jurisdictions? And then the other question is that the stuff that you're taking off the top in the distribution, you talked about debt service, you talked about other elements that you're required to take off. More debt is it fair to assume, diminishes or decreases the amount of local government share?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, good question. So in terms of the first question around the funding that goes to local governments, how heavy our thumb is on the project selection depends on the program. So, for example, the Surface Transportation Program, which is the largest single block of federal dollars, that is a straight pass-through to the large metropolitan planning organizations and the local governments, and they select the projects within those programs. The Enhance Program, on the other hand, is one where the transportation, and I should add, in the STP program, those funding levels for each jurisdiction are set either by Congress or by an agreement between ODOT and the cities and counties. In the Enhance program, the Transportation Commission determines how many or how much money will be in that program, what the sideboards are, what the eligibility criteria, and then generally allows the ACTS, the Area Commissions on Transportation, to make recommendations. In the local bridge program, there is a selection committee of ODOT and local bridge staff who look at the data from our management systems based on bridge inspections and then make decisions based on that. Similarly, with that All Roads Transportation Safety, you have, in that case, to some degree, state projects competing against local projects to pick the best projects. So within each of these funding streams, it is really a very different question. Now, in terms of the question around debt service, it really depends on the individual program. So, for example, in the OTIA 1 program, all of that funding that was created went to ODOT to pay for debt service for state highway projects, was not distributed 50-30-20. So that essentially came off the top. Now, when the debt service is paid or when the debt is paid off, the bonds are paid off, that money is then split 50-30-20. In the Jobs and Transportation Act, on the other hand, the funding for the bonds came out of ODOT's share. There was $960 million of projects, $840 million with the bonds. Some of those were local projects, particularly in eastern Oregon. That all came out of ODOT's 50% of the JTA. The OTIA 3 program was yet different. In that case, much of the bonded funds actually came out of existing ODOT funds. For example, our bridge program was bonded. And some other funding sources. So I will tell you, it's very idiosyncratic depending on how past legislatures have written the distribution formulas.
Thank you.
Senator McClain.
I just had a real quick question about a comment that you made about PED and sidewalk facilities can use the fuel dollars or the fuel tax dollars, right, gas tax, if they are in the highway right away?
Yes, that is correct.
Gentlemen, we have some written questions that have come in. We will funnel those through Patrick to you, and we will have you come in at a later date. I'm sure we will have many more questions about all of the things that you have discussed tonight. And we thank you very much for your testimony tonight. I'd like to invite up Representative Taylor and Representative Bentz to the dais to do a brief presentation. And then in the queue, we will begin our public comment right after that. And my first panel will be Mr. Bennett, Mr. Fernandez, and Mr. Gebhardt. Please just be in the wings ready to step up quickly as soon as Representative Benson, Representative Taylor finish. And I think I will ask Representative Taylor to go first because she can be excused at the end of that and head back to Portland.
Okay.
We'll have Representative Benson on second.
Yes, excellent.
Okay.
Welcome, Representative Taylor.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Co-Chairs Byers and Representative McHugh, Senator Byer and Representative McHugh and members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Representative, House District 41, Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. I want to thank the committee for the hard work you are doing and for traveling throughout the state to assess our infrastructure needs and for meeting with citizens in their communities to learn about their priorities. I decided to speak today in order to voice my support for specific considerations within the transportation package that will come before the legislature in the 2017 session. I urge investment in multimodal transportation investment. More specifically, this means targeted investment in public transit, bicycle, and pedestrian transportation options. It is vital that when we are considering these investments, we take into account safety needs, environmental impacts, and equity. Additionally, I value that this committee has modernization in its title. It is important that we, as a legislature, remain forward-thinking in our transportation options and take into account new technologies and non-fossil fuel transportation options to manage our growing populations. We must make certain that these investments go to infrastructure improvements, including multimodal, that will make sense 20 to 50 years from now. Southeast Portland is one of the fastest growing areas in the Portland metropolitan area. A group, including many of my constituents, are here today, and several rode their bikes all the way from Portland, Oregon, or they met in Wilsonville and then continued on here today, and they're going to be, some of them are going to be testifying later. Again, I want to emphasize some of the top priorities for my constituents, which are efficient multimodal transportation options, minimizing environmental impacts, and safety. As many of you are probably aware, several roadways in Southeast Portland, specifically Powell Boulevard and Highway 26, are particularly very dangerous, and far too many tragic events have occurred. Very recently, two of these incidents took place not far from my home, and the victim of these incidents were teenagers. I ask that you hear the requests and concerns of the individuals who are here from my district and across the state that are here to advocate for multimodal transportation, including important safety measures. I appreciate you allowing me to testify today. Thank you, co-chairs.
Thank you so much, Representative Taylor, for being here today. Representative Bentz.
I'm co-chair, Mr. Co-chair, Mr. President. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Cliff Bentz, State Representative of District 60. This PowerPoint is one I have shown and will be showing to my city councils and my county commissions in the five counties I have the privilege to represent in Eastern Oregon. We will be sealing some of the slides I saw earlier because they're excellent, and would make my you know how you compare a department that runs on billions to a state representative's office that runs on $12, and it's so unfair comparison. Okay, there's my district. As you can see, it's 1/3 of the state. There are that many miles of road in my district, 12,265. This is how they break down, and let's see if this works. There's the little dot there. You can see Baker County, but you see 12,265 miles. So should Oregonia support a gas tax increase? That's the question everyone's worried about in my district. How much state gas tax does an average Oregonian pay? I usually ask this question. You've heard me describe what happened the last time I did, and the young lady responded in Ontario, $6,000. Here's the real amount right there. That is the amount that you actually pay if, keep in mind, it's 30 cents a gallon for the state tax, and you drive 10,000 miles a year, which the average Oregonian does, and you get 20 miles per gallon. You will burn this many gallons of gas in a year, as you can see, 511, and you take 30 cents times that, and you get that number. And so it's slightly less than $6,000. That's more like what I pay for gas as I've driven to all these committee meetings. So divide that by 12 months, and you have $12 a month, or 1.5 cents a mile, which is one heck of a deal when you think about the fact you're using about $1 million asset to drive over for 1 mile, about 1.5 cents to use it. Not bad. Of course, this is not the only way to pay for our roads. And here's the same slide, slightly aged, and I'll steal the one that ODOT showed us earlier, comparing what other states pay. This shocks many of the people. I used this actually 8 years ago when I was having the same conversation regarding the JTA. So we don't maintain our roads. What will we pay for instead of gas? This is a picture of Mike McLean in his younger days. odd looking. He's got a checkered background. So instead of $153, you can buy new tires. Or this is a picture taken in Portland just last week. And, this is I wish they'd take care of the streets there. They don't. But here is the avenue. You could buy these shock absorbers or all four, or you can tow your car. This is the time lost as you try to drive more slowly over these potholes. How's your 30 cents being spent? I'm going to steal. This is what everybody thinks. This is what we do down here. But this is actually how it really is. And then I show how we divide the money up. I show what the state's share was in a biennium, and these numbers are not correct. They'll look a lot better after I steal from the other PowerPoint we saw earlier. We'll put in where the money is going, we'll put in the actual road budget. We'll put in what the counties are spending it on. This is Malheur County, and I want to show people that the part spent on labor has dropped precipitously over the past few years. Cities, I'm still looking for that. Why isn't what you're currently paying enough? I mean, everybody's going to ask that. And, of course, we're going to put in the asphalt costs going up, the gravel costs going up, And then what happens if we don't take care of our maintenance? We'll talk about the increase in labor costs going up. The weather damage to the roads. This is the road I think I drove over coming back from the coast in Senator Johnson's district. Still looks that way. More water going over that road than we have in all of Eastern Oregon. And there's a place that needs a bridge.
Culvert.
What are bridge conditions? This is the Selwood Bridge being blown up or falling apart. I'm not sure which. It's not replaced. These are the conditions of the bridges in the entire state. Here's a better slide of it. These are the conditions of our bridges if we don't get some money to fix them. Congestion, of course, a big problem. This shows the increase in traffic down near the CRC. Safety, huge issue, and we've heard a lot about it, and we need to do something about it. This shows the worst place to go in the state, which is Portland, because it's incredibly dangerous. Look at all of that, and we need to do something about it. Seismic, we've heard a great deal about it. I have a solution, of course, but I want to point out that the challenge. We have the Cascadia event on the horizon, and I got some depictions of what Seaside's going to look like. Here it is. It's just slightly down the coast from Seaside, but nonetheless, some of the way it might look, again, just down the coast from Seaside. Here's a ship brought in from the sea, crushing Seaside. There is Seaside, and there's President Courtney's car, much to for wear. So I have found a place for us to stage which will not be affected by this event. There it is, Ontario. Because I need some help from someone who is chairing this committee, I have a new freeway going across the of all places, Coos Bay.
Winnemucca to the sea, I believe they called that at one point.
And then the real staging area is right there, of course, on Highway 97. Who actually pays for the roads? I like to show my people, and once they understand this, they are all in favor of raising Willamette Valley taxes. Because as you can see, people are in the Willamette Valley. And what happens is, since half of each dollar comes back to the people deserving folk, I show the money coming out of the Willamette Valley and coming back to, me. And so that's good. Why really should urban people even care about my part of the state? Here you go. Public safety is a good one. This transportation, in case the event does occur, when it does occur, commerce, all these others. And they're all really good reasons to give me most of the money from whatever we raise. And then why should we give the money to ODOT? A great question. Is it doing its job? A better question. We've had these allegations of these problems. Maybe they're there, maybe they're not. That's why we're spending that amount of money on an audit. This is a very important slide, and I want people to know that we take that their concerns seriously, and we're looking into it. We need some more state troopers now that we go a lot faster on the roads as a result of the chair sitting up there. Yes, probably we do, but we call out the price. And that is the end of my slide presentation.
Representative Benz, thank you very much. I would suspect that we have a number of committee members who may be stealing portions of your PowerPoint to use in our own communities as we go back and try and...
we'll pay him to put our numbers in.
Explain it, yes. Or his staff, maybe. Senator Johnson.
A question, and this is more rhetorical than it is directed at...
Thank you, Representative
Taylor. But one of the comments that Mr. Brower made was how relatively easy it is to get bike ped money when you had your Connect Oregon slide up there. And one of the questions that I would ask is, when we changed to allow bike ped to qualify for Connect, they've gobbled up a pretty good percentage of it. If the federal money is so easy to get, why should we take the scarce Connect money that may be in jeopardy if certain ballot measures pass and spend it on bike ped that's easy to get from federal sources?
So, that's rhetorical. Would you like me, are they still
that's
in the
rhetorical.
Room?
I'm looking at Travis while I was talking.
I don't want to spend too much time because we're 5 minutes into our public hearing, but...
Just leave it as a rhetorical question.
Could we have him answer that at a future meeting?
Sure.
That would be helpful. Thank you very much, Senator. And I wanted to... President Courtney, we are in your district, I believe. Is there a comment you would like to make while we're going into our public hearing? Okay. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Then I will call up Mr. Bennett, Mr. Fernandez, and Mr. Gebhardt, please. We have enough people signed up that if we succinctly finish testimony in 3 minutes, we can get through everyone that is on the list. So we would like people to please keep your testimony short and sweet. I believe Patrick is going to manage a clock when it turns red. You're done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm a member of the Salem City Council. I'm here to give some testimony on behalf of the City of Salem. You have received a letter from our mayor, Anna Peterson, and I'll just sort of boil that down into a much shorter, I hope, presentation. As you're probably aware, because you're in Salem a great deal of the time, we operate a very extensive surface transportation system. Like most cities, we have a backlog of maintenance. One thing I can tell you about Salem, we've been very successful in our capital improvement area. Our problem comes in maintenance, which brings us here to talk to you about the three things we think are probably most important you'll be looking at. We would like to suggest to you, you increase and index the state gas tax and licensing and registration fees. We'd like you to fund analysis, design, and construction of seismic upgrades to critical state transportation facilities. And hopefully it's no surprise that particularly we're interested in the Center and Marion Street bridges across the Willamette River. And we hope you will continue programs that fund improvement to transportation facilities that support economic development, particularly the McGilchrist Street Southeast Improvement in South Salem. And I can go into greater depth, or I have with me Peter Fernandez, our Public Works Director, who can go further into that if you'd like us to.
That would be delightful, sir. And, of course, you're welcome to drop your written testimony with the staff, and we'll put it up on OLIS, and everybody will have an opportunity to read it. If anyone has written testimony, please feel free to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've submitted our written testimony. Thank you.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only comment, Peter Fernandez, I'm the Public Works Director at the City of Salem. I'd just like to reemphasize what Councilor Bennett has stated, that really our number one priority is increased maintenance money. The city has had great success in our citizens in with our citizens in passing bond issues for capital projects. We have other sources that are available to us. We use federal funds. We use systems development charge funds. But maintenance money is the one that is really hard to come by, and the only way to address that is through an increase in the gas tax and having cities collect their share of that. The council passed a streetlight fee last year. That has been a nice stopgap for us with respect to funding, because it freed up money from our maintenance budget to be able to do some pavement maintenance and the like. But we know that that's going to run out in 3 to 5 years, and then we'll be back in a tough situation. So we really, the maintenance money is what we are really in need of. So I appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Gibbard.
Hello, I'm Daniel Gibbard. I'm here representing Bike Lab PDX. We are the contingent that rode down from Portland on bikes. We're here with several asks. We're here to ask that ODOT implement a safety-first policy, that safety projects should receive priority on facilities that do not reach safety metrics. We're here asking that ODOT adopt and implement a Vision Zero policy. We're here asking for scenario four to be fully funded within the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Plan. We're here asking for a process for ODOT to cede jurisdiction of its urban highways, the ones that have terrible safety records, to the cities in which they are within. We are here to ask for a dedicated percentage of STIP funding for bicycle and pedestrian programs. We're here to ask for a dramatically expanded program for safe routes to schools.
Thank you, sir. May I ask in the audience how many people rode their bikes down with Mr. Gibbard? Right. Thank you very much.
Great.
Questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up, I would like to call Alan Pollack, Sean Abbey, and Kathy Clark, please. And in the wings, I believe the way I'm reading this, it would be the Kaufman family. Up next, please. Yeah. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Chair McCune, Chair Beyer, Co-Vice Chairs Boquist and Benz. I'm Alan Pollack. I'm the General Manager for Salem Kaiser Transit. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. As background, Salem Kaiser Transit is the public transportation provider for Marion and Polk counties. Within the urban growth boundary of Salem and Kaiser, we operate the Chariot service, which is our fixed route service, as well as the paratransit service called Cherry Lift. In the rural portions of the county, we operate the Chemeketa Area Regional Transportation System, or CARTS, to the small towns in rural Marion and Polk County. We also provide commuter service to Wilsonville, as well as the community of Grand Ronde. We're the senior and disabled transit provider for Marion and Polk County through our Cherry Lift service. We also operate shopper shuttles, as well as a general dialer ride. And I would add our chariots and cart service, our regular service, is a huge carrier of people with seniors and people with disabilities. The chariots is funded through local property tax, our state in lieu of payment, and passenger fares. The district has been struggling over the last several years. We have significant challenges. We have sought to seek out a stable funding that will, an additional stable funding to allow an investment in transit services in the community, and have been unsuccessful. As a result, we eliminated weekend service in 2009, and that has had a significant impact in this community, especially for seniors, people with disabilities, our vulnerable population, and our non-traditional workers, what I define as the retail and restaurant sector, the evening and weekend worker. They have no access to transportation to get to their jobs. We have been working with local community partners over the years to try to find ways to invest. I'm joined today with one of our partners, the Chamber of Commerce, will testify in just a minute. But despite all this, we need help. This community is struggling. We are looking to see strong state leadership on transit funding. Without it, we are going to see a continual spiral downward for small urban and rural transit districts who are just trying to maintain minimum levels of service. With that, I'd thank you for allowing me to testify. Our board has already submitted written testimony. They would be here this evening, but we are concurrently running our board meeting, which I will go to right after this, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Abbey, welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs Byer and McCune, thank you for allowing me to speak this evening. I'm Sean Abbey. I'm a small business owner here in the Salem area and also serve on the board of directors for the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce. It's a pleasure to be part of this process. And as a business and representing the business community, we also agree that the Salem Area Transit definitely needs some help. They an attempt was made to pass a property tax, which failed, and also a payroll tax, which failed. So, but we also understand excessively that the Salem Area Transit definitely needs some funding help. The opportunities are immense. There's what they need for an opportunity, as far as a business perspective, is definitely efficient routing to keep the buses out of the flow of traffic and also into major efficient routes. Also with the expansion, I live in South Salem and I do not have access to the bus system, and which just tags me over to the downtown area. The downtown Salem area is revitalizing, and that's such an encouraging thing, but the discouraging part is trying to find a parking place downtown. I know for me and my business, and I know for other businesses that I represent, it would be a great thing to be able to just catch a bus every 15 or 30 minutes or so, whatever's reasonable, to catch a bus downtown, do our shopping, take care of business, and then come back in a reasonable fashion. We don't see that now, and we would love to see that in the future as part of the business community. So we ask you just to consider that when putting together this package, but also know that with that revitalized downtown, we can see some tremendous opportunities for growth and for expansion of the Salem Area Transit. Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, sir. Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you both. Your comments on transit, we've heard a lot throughout the state. I guess the question I'd ask you is, do you have a recommendation for us on how to fund transit since our Constitution limits the gas tax and related fees?
Co-Chair Byer, thank you for that question. That is the difficult question for transit. You know, typical transit agencies throughout the country are generally funded through a local sales tax or a gas tax, which are not available to us. The importance, I don't know if I have a good source. That's something we all need to work on to find that
But it is critical that whatever source it is, it's a sustainable source, because a difficult work for a transit agency is not having the comfort in knowing it's going to be sustainable. It's tough to add service when you're not sure if the funding for that service is not going to be there the following year.
Mr. Abbey, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but if you have any clever, brilliant ideas about how we fund transit, we would love to hear them.
That's a good question. I agree with my colleague here. That is a very difficult question, not being in your position. I do know that as far as fares and as far as public funds, is the only thing that just me as a business can imagine that would be able to fund that.
And but I think fare boxes question. Tend to cover 15-20% maybe of the cost over less. Average, less. Yeah, statewide. So, okay, thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate
thank
your
you.
Testimony today. I'd like to call up the Kaufman family and then have in the wings Jason Barbose, Jim Shepke, and Corey Cool, please, ready to step up next. Welcome.
Thank you.
There's my little young man. I was born on April
14th. Co-Chair Beyer and McEwen, thank you for having us. And I'd also like to thank the committee for all the work that you've done traveling around the state recently. It's really valuable, and I'm sure you've heard a lot of different perspectives. My name is Dan Kaufman. These are my sons, Aiden, Arthur, and Lucas. We're representing... And I'm representing Families for a Safer Powell. I'm the chairman of that. And but I'm here with my three sons. Their health and safety is my number one concern. And when it comes to the 2017 transportation funding package, we want to see safety put first. And that means in the actual budget, not just in the things that we say, but the actual dollars. And for all users, especially our most vulnerable users. Families for a Safer Powell kind of is an offshoot of the Cleveland PTA. And we looked at the problems around Cleveland High School, where about one student every semester is being put in the hospital, according to a vice principal that I spoke with. And we know that there's many fatalities that are happening around there on Highway 26. And so we started looking at the big picture, and we realized that Powell Boulevard is a high crash corridor in Portland, all the way from the Ross Island Bridge out to Gresham and beyond. But especially in that section, we see fatalities all the time. A bus facility, the bus stop right in front of the school got wiped out last winter by a car that hit it in the night. Now, if that had happened during school session, we could have lost quite a few of our students there. So we want to see, again, safety, and we want to see these roads, these orphan freeways that are all throughout our state, whether you're talking about Klamath Falls, Lincoln City, anywhere, we have these orphan freeways that are not safe facilities. And when folks say that safety's put first, I say come and look at a 35-mile-an-hour road next to my children's high school. So, and I want to give the opportunity for my sons if they want to say anything.
Well, when it comes to Powell Boulevard, I think that...
May I ask you to say your name for the record, please?
Oh, my name's Lucas Kaufman.
Thank you.
And I think that for Powell Boulevard, one of the big problems where I see a source of danger is that when kids try to cross where there isn't an intersection or where there isn't, like, a crosswalk, there's very long stretches where there isn't a crosswalk. And so if you're trying to go to a place that's across the street, and you may have to walk about like six blocks just to get to a crosswalk. And also there's no bike path on Powell Boulevard. You have to either bike on a side street or bike on the sidewalk, which isn't very safe. And I think that, I don't know, maybe it's hard for me to say anything because I don't really know exactly how all this stuff works, but
you're here, I guess, learning.
If
I'm impressed.
If they were to lower the speed limit even 5 miles per hour, that would make it so that people, instead of going 40 miles instead of 35 miles, like they're going 5 miles over the speed limit, then it'd be down to 35 over the, which is still over the speed limit. And maybe have the speed limit be like 25 or 30 instead of 35, I think that would make it a lot safer, especially if you're talking about like people getting hit. If you're hit by a car and it's only going 20 miles per hour, like the chances of you living are a lot higher than getting hit by a car going 35, 40 miles per hour. I don't know. That's
thank you.
Something that
well done, sir. Aiden, did you wish to comment? And Arthur, do you have anything to add to the commentary here?
No.
Arthur, I have to tell you, you're the, one of the few people I know with that name. My husband's name is Jeffrey Arthur, and you must be a fine young man to have that wonderful, distinguished name. So the Kaufman family, thank you so much for being here today. Let's see if there are any questions for the panel.
Do you know
Senator Winters?
Master Arthur and I met earlier today, and Master Arthur's birthday is April 14th. And, of course, he learned that mine was the 15th.
Oh, my
today.
Gosh.
His aunt's birthday.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah.
Well, we thank you very much for listening to us today.
And we very much appreciate you being
we're
here.
We're going to step out now, and thank you so much.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Senator.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that area. I've represented Southeast Portland for about 40 years. Don't ride your bike on Powell. Ride your bike on Clinton. Clinton is designed as a bike-friendly street. And you'll be safe there. They've got the controls and so on. City of Portland has set aside Clinton and Lincoln as bike streets, and that's what you ought to use. I don't want you mixing with fast cars on Powell.
Good advice. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure having you. Mr. Barbos, Shepke, and Poole, and up in the... In the wings, we have Lori Doherty, Josh Chernoff, and pardon me if I'm getting these names wrong, and Mark Connect, I believe, on deck.
Good evening.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Jason Barbos. I'm with the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're a national nonprofit organization. We advance science for a healthier planet and a safer world, and appreciate the opportunity to briefly speak. Very clear from the presentations today, Representative Bentz is perhaps most so, that Oregonians are very deserving of investments in safe and reliable infrastructure. And so commend your efforts on that and wish you the best as you collaborate going forward. I was hoping to make a couple recommendations around strategies that as you reduce or as you consider modernizing the state's transportation infrastructure, that you also consider strategies to reduce oil consumption and pollution. And you've already heard a bit about transit and biking and pedestrian safety, and we certainly support those measures. But our expertise really lies in advanced vehicle technologies and fuels, and so I wanted to make a couple suggestions around particularly vehicle electrification. I think committee members would know that there are a number of important benefits that electrifying transportation fleet brings. One is reduced fuel costs. It's about one-third of the cost to drive on electricity as your fuel as opposed to gasoline or diesel. The other is keeping money in Oregon's economy, reducing oil use, keeping the money in state and helping induce local jobs as a result. And then finally, reducing pollution. Driving on an electric vehicle in Oregon with your electricity mix is equivalent carbon emissions to driving a gasoline car that got 75 miles per gallon. And that will only get better as the state reduces its reliance on coal-fired electricity and ramps up renewables. The couple suggestions on programs to consider. One is a rebate incentive for electric vehicle and plug-in hybrid passenger cars. This is probably the number one thing you can do to jumpstart the market and grow the market for electric cars in Oregon. A recent survey of rebate recipients in California showed that 90% said that the state rebate was an important part of their decision to purchase an electric vehicle. In addition, there are important opportunities on heavy-duty vehicles to electrify some end uses in that segment. for commercialized hybrid and electric vehicle technologies. Similar voucher incentive programs can be very impactful. These would include, for example, delivery trucks, airport ground equipment, and transit buses. And these are technologies that are in the marketplace, but they have higher upfront costs and could use a little boost. And then the final is demonstration projects for what we consider pre-commercial technologies. These are types, programs are important to prove out technology, support early manufacturing, encourage fleet testing, and promising end uses for these include drayage trucks that operate in and out of ports, port equipment itself, cargo handling equipment at airports, agricultural equipment, and construction equipment. So, of course, the question of revenue, where this money would come from, is an important one, but we hope you keep these ideas in the mix as you continue your work. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Chepke. I live here in Salem, and I'm here representing a grassroots organization here in Salem called No Third Bridge. And you're going to hear a lot tonight about projects that people do want. I'm here to tell you about a project that the majority of people here in Salem don't want. It's called the Salem River Crossing, and it would be a brand new $500 million bridge that's been in the planning stages now for 10 years. $7 million of our precious transportation dollars have been spent on this planning. It would stretch from North Salem to West Salem. It would be 3/4 of a mile through an earthquake liquefaction zone outside of the UGB. We already have 8 lanes here in Salem. We can add 3 more lanes to the bridges we have for about $150 million, and yet this project continues and continues to go on to build a $500 million bridge. We think we can add lanes to the bridges we have, we can improve our transit system, we can add bike and pedestrian facilities, and that way we can have we can solve our peak hour congestion problems without the Salem River Crossing project. As I said, planning began in 2006. We've spent $7 million on planning. We need a transportation package from you in the next session, and we're very much for that, but not to build the third bridge in Salem that local citizens don't want. And by the way, it would displace 55 homes and 65 businesses. We need to fix it first here in Salem. You heard that from our city leaders, and I was glad to hear that from them. The retrofit of the Marion and Center Street Bridge should be job one. So I hope we can pull the plug on this third bridge project that's gone on for 10 years now, and I hope we can proceed to fix it first and to meet our needs in that way here in Salem. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much for making the time to see us, have us speak to you today. My name is Corey Poole with Northwest Gate Coalition. Today I skateboarded 40 miles to be here with you. I would do it again and again because something really needs to be done to address the tragic injury and loss of life that we are seeing in our roadways across the state. This year in Portland, we've seen the deaths, I believe, of 33 people who are using their feet and bicycles to get around. PBOT has made some improvements, adding crosswalks, bike lanes, flashing beacons, but with Portland's population booming and roadway congestion just getting worse and worse, there's so much more that needs to be done. We're just not keeping pace with the need. We need to prioritize the safety of Oregonians. When there are still schools without proper crosswalks, when there are whole neighborhoods surrounded by busy highways with no way out by any means other than a car, we cannot continue to ignore these problems. I'm asking you to consider taking action in 3 ways. First, I would really like to see cities have the ability to manage their own roadways, like we were just hearing about, control speed, add crosswalks without having to run it through ODOT, which often results in nothing occurring when the people who are living there are demanding it. Second, we need to fully fund the $100 million annual budget described in the ODOT bike ped plan, perhaps adding an additional tax to the gas tax. I don't know if that would constitutionally wash or not, but some mechanism needs to be created. Third, we need to dramatically expand safe routes to school. When kids cannot safely walk, skate, or ride their bikes to school, they're forced to ride in cars much of the time. This only contributes to the congestion, and it also compounds the existing safety problems that are existing in the first place. We saw this yesterday when a mother and two children were hit outside their school in Hillsborough yesterday. I mean, it's happening constantly. This is not a Portland problem. This is an Oregon problem. I don't think there's a community in the entire state that's not impacted by these safety issues, and I really hope that we can find a statewide solution. Thank you.
I believe we are constitutionally prohibited from using gas tax dollars for bike ped. So do you have any other suggestions as to where we might find revenue? Have you and your organization had some time to think about that?
I mean, just myself speaking, I would dramatically increase the registration fees. I mean, I've lived in other states. We are really...
Same problem.
No. Well.
Constitutional problem.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir. Senator?
What about a minimal tax on bicycles?
I think that adding anything that would discourage people from riding bicycles or getting bicycles should be a non-starter. I mean, bicycles reduce congestion. They actually lower the infrastructure costs in streets. You know, you can fit hundreds of bicycles in the space of a number of cars. I would hate to see anything that would discourage the use of more bicycles or skateboards.
I ride my bicycle all the time, and if I bought a new one, I wouldn't mind a small sales tax to fund bicycle projects.
Maybe a general sales tax.
Whole another set of problems. Representative Benz.
So I might suggest to those of you from Portland that you might want to talk to your representatives about the low carbon fuel standard. Because with appropriate tailoring, you could utilize the money it generates to build bike ped. But you need to tell them that. Otherwise, they won't. You have to tell them to do that. And if you do, perhaps we would be able to direct some of that money in a way that currently will not occur as it's currently crowned.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see. Up next, we had 1, 2, 3. Ms. Doherty, Mr. Chernoff, and Mark, I believe it's Connect, but correct me if I'm wrong. And in the wings, we have Rolf Sordon, Rick Lewis, and Lori Benoit. Welcome to our committee. In any order you choose, please.
She will go first.
My name is Lori Doherty, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I live here in Salem. I rode my bike here too, but not 40 miles, just about 3/4 of a mile down the road, but I ride often around Salem. I am the co-coordinator of 350 Salem, Oregon, the local chapter of the Global Climate Action Organization, 350.org. But I'm speaking for myself. These are my own views, but they're informed and made urgent by a longstanding commitment and involvement in activities to combat climate change. Transportation is the largest source of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. Any transportation legislation going forward must address this issue by increasing the capacity for safe and convenient alternative modes of transportation. Although I share the use of my daughter's car, but as much as possible, I bike, walk, and ride the bus for my daily errands and activities. Before I retired from a job in another state, I often bike to work and use public transit going to work. I know from long experience that these modes of travel that are healthier for the climate are also healthier for people and for communities. Biking, walking, and transit usually involves walking or biking, you know, to a bus stop or a station. So they provide exercise and more pleasant and less stressful journeys. They produce far less traffic congestion and reduce the pollution that can cause asthma and many other diseases. We don't need more highways or bridges. We do need well-maintained streets and intersections that are safe and convenient for all users, young, old, and in between, whether on foot or bicycles or in wheelchairs as well as motor vehicles. And by the way, today is International Car-Free Day, September 22nd. International Car-Free Day. In some countries, it's a big deal, and they make a big deal about it, but you don't hear much about it around here. And with all due respect, I think it's your... it's on you to come up with the funding and the revenue to produce these alternative modes of transportation that we really, really need. That's your job.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Hello. Thank you, Madam Chairman and the rest of the committee for hearing me today. My name is Josh Chernoff. I biked 52 miles from Portland to be here today. And just like the Kaufman family, who has spoken about Powell, and my representative in my district has spoken about Powell before, we all know that it's a very dangerous street. The current speed limit there is 35 miles an hour. One of the things that you all may be familiar with if you go by any other school is that you may see a sign that says 20 miles an hour and blinking lights. But because Cleveland High School sits adjacent to Powell Boulevard, which is Highway 26, this local government does not have the ability to change those speed limits. So I come here asking that we give local government the ability to set speed limits in areas that we feel necessary, such as a high school where there's children present. 35 miles an hour in front of a high school is not safe. I heard recommendations of using Clinton. Personally use Clinton. I think it's a brilliant project. The difficulty of Clinton is you still have to cross Powell. And in doing so, on that very stretch of street, 26th, in May of 2015, a young man lost his leg. Not even 17 days later, a man lost his life just next to my home, not even a couple blocks down on 39th and Gladstone. So another thing that I'm asking is the ability to have radar or speed cameras. One of the issues in Portland is we don't have enough police officers. So enforcing current speed laws is a very difficult problem. We have technology to hold people accountable, which we could potentially use as revenue via speed tickets and such. I don't know if that's allowed. We're looking for ways of bringing in money. Well, what about holding people who abuse our roadways accountable to help fund some of these projects? If you abuse our right-of-ways, help support the right-of-ways. Cameras would help enforce a particular stretch of road that is difficult to enforce with the amount of police officers that we have available to do so. I could have driven down here today, but I chose not to because I wanted to represent my child who can't drive. And the school that she goes to does not provide public buses. They give her a bus ticket. So she has to find her own means of transportation via TriMet or by biking, and so does all the other children there. So thank you for the time and hearing me out.
So thank you for taking the time to come. Welcome, sir.
Yes, thank you, Senator Beyer. My name is Mark Connect. I do a lot of advocacy work for people with disabilities in this community. Several years ago, when they put the new Social Security office out there on McGillcrest and the new Salem Outreach Veterans Clinic out there, I was one of the driving forces behind that because they had to make the three blocks from Pringle and McGillcrest from the West End handicap accessible. And so when Kurt Schrader and Senator Merkley were here, they took the mayor out there. The city did not have the money to do that. They had to comply with the ADA. Now, I took the ODOT was aware that railroad crossing is being used for people to get there. Now, the federal did not know that. So I took the liberty to call the Federal Railroad Administration up in Vancouver and Washington. That's where their office is for Salem and for Oregon and Washington. Okay, so now we have NORPAC out there and that industrial area. And sometimes when I come out of the VA clinic, I will stand there and I will watch. We have those signs for a crosswalk. People don't stop there. We need flashing lights out there like they do up here on Lancaster and those sort of things because it's an accident waiting to happen. And so I know that area needs to be fixed because the buses can't go up and down that McGillcrest safely with the public transit can't go up and down down there and let people off safely. So that's why they have to be left off at that corner and then have to come three blocks. And people in wheelchairs and stuff, you know, that have to use public transit to get there. Well, okay, so I did what I could. But anyway, I do a lot of advocacy for people with handicaps. And like Alan Pollock says, you know, I don't know what the Chamber of Commerce, no matter what the Transit District does in this community, that the Chamber of Commerce turns around and fights it every tooth and nail, whether it's right or wrong. And the defeat went down, the business tax went down in defeat. Okay, Salem Memorial is our biggest biggest employer in the Salem besides the state. Okay, so then when they said it would cut into their profits over there. Okay, when all the bookwork was done, when all the smoke and the bookwork and the ink was put to the paper, it would only cost them maybe $170 a year for that. And then they complained that they want people to come to work on weekends and stuff. Well, the employer said, well, we'll hire you. And so if they can't get to work, you know, that's all right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony.
Here, I have it written.
If you wouldn't mind, Patrick will come get it from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for hearing.
Up next, Rolf Sorden, Rick Lewis, and Lori Benoit. And on deck, we have, it looks like Soren or Lauren Impey, Courtney Grace Henrick, and Sean Abbey. And then we'll have one panel after that. Pardon me?
Did we do Sean Abbey?
I think it's a different... Sean, oh, yes. Yes, we did, on twice. Thank you, Senator. Welcome to our committee.
Okay. Hello, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and the other representatives. My name is Lori Benoit.
My apologies, Benoit.
Yes, Benoit. Today, I did ride a bicycle here more than 50 miles. I have ridden this year across the state, probably close to 2,000 miles at one time in five different states this year. I do ride all over, and what I've found consistently is that today I rode 99, and I was coming through a tunnel. There should be a light and say there's a bike in there. It's like literally no room, and you're going around a corner outside of Oregon City. That is the most beautiful stretch of road there, and it is the most inaccessible for about 10 miles till you get to Canby. Very inaccessible for bicycles. And the same thing, Highway 101 going up and down the coast. There are bike signs, but there's a lot of places where there needs to just be a light and things to let people know. I was riding over in Eastern Oregon, went from Florence clear from the beach to the border. Same thing over there. There's a bunch of signs. They want to take all those signs down that say that they're bikeways, and they want to do that because there's too many bicyclists there is what they're saying. And it should be just the opposite. We need to be thinking outside of the auto, thinking outside of being in our cars. We are too used to jumping in our cars rather than getting on a bike, walking, hiking, being on a longboard or a skateboard. Those are the things that we need to be thinking. Or, you know, we should be bringing up, our communities and our children and, you know, everyone just having that as a mindset. That's the way it is in many communities in Europe. And it's ridiculous that we're so orientated toward our personal cars, mass transit. There are simple solutions. This weekend, they're closing down to any cars down in Crater Lake. Only bicycles. You can walk and hike and, you know, have longboards, anything else, but no automobiles. They need to do that in the gorge where it's horrible going there. And it's not because of speed or anything. A lot of these places, it's just because there are so many people there that are in automobiles. It's polluting the areas that are beautiful and not making it accessible at all. Slow traffic. Bikes can't hardly get through. People can't walk. That's what needs to happen all over, that we need to have one-way streets, closing down the streets like they do. They did it in Yellowstone, too. They did it over McKenzie Pass when I did it in May. And those are the kinds of things that need to happen. we need to get out of our cars. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate you being here. Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Lewis. I'm the mayor of the city of Silverton. With me tonight is our city manager, Bob Willoughby. He's in the front row here. First of all, I want to thank you for the work you're doing. This is a very important subject, and it's very important to the community. So the message that I'm bringing to you tonight is from a perspective of a smaller community, and it's a plea for financial assistance for cities. We're a small city. Silverton's population is just under 10,000, and we have limited financial resources like everyone else does. In your financial planning related to transportation, we'd ask that you please remember the smaller communities and understand that we need your help. Silverton has a $50 million investment in roadways within our city, and that investment's at risk at the present time. With the condition of the streets that we have, about 1/20th of our streets investment should be replaced each year in order to preserve it. And we're not doing that. We can't afford it. Our taxpayers can't afford it. They can't carry the burden by themselves. And as we all know, the federal grant funds that used to be available for infrastructure have dried up to quite an extent. Our streets were evaluated by a consultant in 2012. And their report recommended that a $15 a month street fee per household be imposed on our citizens in order to preserve that investment of streets. Our current street fee is set at $6.07 a month, and that includes several incremental increases over the last couple of years. That's all our citizens can afford with the water and sewer rate annual increases that we've needed to impose. So I want to talk about just a couple of areas that you could help us with. Safe routes to schools. We're receiving increasing parental complaints about the safety of children crossing the state highways to get to school, primarily middle school age and elementary school age kids. We've seen multiple accidents on those highways. We have a stretch of a state highway that's probably a half a mile inside the city, a half mile in length with no crosswalks, and the kids need to cross there. We also have some of the worst streets in those neighborhoods with no sidewalks. There's no sidewalks along state highways, so these are some of the areas that we're concerned about. I want to talk about one street in particular in town, McLean. Representative Benz showed a slide of a really serious problem with one of the streets. It's starting to look that way on that street. And it's a connection between Silverton and Salem. So we're asking for you to please be cognizant of the needs of the smaller communities and help us out all you can. We'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions? All right, thank you very much. Rolf Sorden was on the list and did not come up. Are you here this evening? Next up, the last name, I-M-P-E-Y, Impey. Thank you for being here. Courtney Grace Henrick and Sean Abbey, I believe, has already testified. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the co-chairs and the committee for allowing me the opportunity to provide testimony. So my name is Soren Impey, and I am a co-founder of Livable Streets Action, a grassroots advocacy group focused on road safety and active transportation. And I wanted to highlight the traffic safety crisis in this state. So looking at the past 2 years of year-round statistics, over 800 people have died on our roads. This is a dramatic increase over 2013 numbers. Mm-hmm. And of those fatalities, you know, the increase for people walking has been around 50%. You know, this is, I think this really is a crisis. If hundreds of people in Oregon were dying due to a public health crisis, let's say Zika, the state would spare no expense, you know, working to end these fatalities. And it's not just fatalities, it's serious injury accidents that permanently change people's lives. So I was, you know, excited about the opportunity of a 2017 transportation package that would increase funding for road safety. But when I looked at the One Oregon plan, I really could find very little money dedicated to improving road safety. You know, there's possibly a little bit of money in the bicycle pedestrian infrastructure proposal, $25 million, but hundreds of millions are allocated to, you know, adding more lanes to freeways. I think I would urge you to look at this public health crisis and to consider dedicating more money to road safety. And I want to emphasize that this is not something that only benefits people walking, people biking, people skating, but also people driving. The changes to our roads, you know, that could be done with additional funding, you know, would result in decreased fatalities for all users. And this has been demonstrated over and over again. Many states, several states, cities in the USA have adopted Vision Zero proposals. And the common theme is that there's been a marked decrease in fatalities across the board. So I would really urge you to dedicate some more money. And there are funding mechanisms. For example, Connect Oregon is a source of money for multimodal safety improvements. The STIP grants could be allocated to safety, road safety, and multimodal investment. For example, a dedicated percentage could be dedicated to safety projects every year, perhaps in an echo of the Oregon Bike Bill. And then I would like to also emphasize that I believe this panel identified some funding mechanisms. Statewide property tax could be used to fund multimodal transportation. Once again, the Connect Oregon transit you know, could be funded with payroll taxes. And I personally, just speaking for myself, I wouldn't mind an excise tax on expensive bicycles. But, you know, as has been indicated in the plan, that's a very poor source of funding. So we really need larger sets of funding for road safety. Thank and you. I just want to finish with one.
And I will need you to wrap up. Thank you.
One little comment. So the representative from ODOT said that it was easy to fund bike ped infrastructure. I want to point to their bike ped plan, where they say that it would take many decades to complete the network at the current level of funding, which is around 30 million years. And they identified 104 million as sort of the type of adequate funding that would, you know, really improve the system, but would still not complete the network. So there really is a big funding deficit. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Courtney Grace Henrich. I really appreciate you guys giving me time to have what I need to say be said. On February 9th, 2013, I was riding my bicycle through Southeast Powell and 26th Avenue, where I was struck by a vehicle that left the scene of the accident. Mind you, this was 1 year and 3 months before the two tragic events, quote unquote, by Representative Taylor had occurred. When the vehicle left the scene of the accident, I was also left unconscious in the middle of the intersection and came to. My name now is Grace. That's my preferred name because that person no longer exists. My life changed in that moment, and I was in my first year of grad school at the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine. I had to relearn how to reread out loud. Things didn't work right. My body still to this day has some pretty large effects based on the accident. I did not stop going to grad school. I just graduated with my master's degree.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was quite a feat. However, I need you to understand that just because you put in a stoplight that people can turn at this point, this is still a very dangerous intersection. I have ridden through there since my accident on February 9, 2013, twice. I now make sure that I live just north of Powell. I don't ride through Powell by myself. This intersection needs cameras. It needs to have limits, speed limits that we can create. There's a school there. And, you know, the more that I walk in this world, I realize that this didn't stop me from riding my bicycle 60 miles today to meet with you. I ride my bike every day. I ride my bike anywhere from 3,000 to 9,000 miles a year. And in the future, I'm planning a bicycle, a healthcare business based on bicycling. And so I want to have safe streets so that I can create a healthcare program for people outside of the norm. So I appreciate you spending taking time listening to me today. And thank you very much.
Well, we're sorry for the experiences that you've had and delighted to have you here tonight. And congratulations. That's quite a feat.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Questions? Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. I believe Mayor Clark, we have you on our list way up at the front, and we had crossed you off assuming you weren't here. Would you like to testify?
I would, thank you.
You're welcome to come and join us. I would also like to call up Marianne Byrne and Juliet Cutts, please.
Good evening, Chair Senator Beyer and Senator Boquist, members of the Joint Transportation Committee. I'm Kathy Clark. I'm the mayor of Kaiser. I'm also the vice chair of the Area Commission of Transportation for the Mid-Willamette Valley, affectionately known as MWACT. I also am a member of the board of directors for the League of Oregon Cities, and it is with the League's policy recommendations for the cities that I'm coming to you tonight. I got a chance to meet with many of you at the meeting here in the Salem-Kaiser area. You got to see some of the projects that we got done. And we were able to get them from concept to completion. They are designed to finish systems. We told you there that our priority is safety. We want to make sure that our systems are complete. Our bikeways, our roadways, and bridges are complete so people have a choice to use them. If a system isn't complete, it's not a choice. Transit is also a high priority for the Salem-Kaiser area. We have many people in our community who are transit dependent or who want to use transit as an option to be able to get to and from jobs. Currently, we only have 5-day-a-week service. The Salem-Kaiser Transit District is a very important partner in our transportation services for the Marion Polk County area. The priority from the League of Oregon Cities, as you probably know, is maintenance and preservation. We want to be able to have the dollars to maintain our systems so that we don't have to reinvest in complete rebuild, but we want to make sure that we have the opportunity to maintain our investment, to keep it safe, to keep it passable, finish systems of roads, bikeways, and sidewalks in order for people in our community to be able to get around safely and securely in a mode that they choose, whatever's going to make sense for them. In Kaiser, we have areas that we have not been able to finish our sidewalks yet. We're working on it. We tee up our projects. We work together collaboratively with Salem, Marion County, and our three-county area with the ACT. And I am so proud to be part of an ACT that looks at our transportation in a regional fashion and works to prioritize our projects to get them built. The Woodburn Interchange was done a year early and under budget, but it took a lot of time to plan that project to make sure it was complete. I'm also on the oversight team for the third bridge for the Willamette River crossing. This is a critical project for the not only Salem-Kaiser, but our region. This is significant for safety. It is significant for resilience. It is significant for making sure traffic can move through safely in all modes. The third bridge is a critical project. We've invested 10 years in the environmental impact statement. You're going to hear more about it as we move that forward as well. But I want to thank you for taking the time to make sure that you understand the importance of all of our transportation systems in the state and Marion County. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, good evening. My name is Juliette Cutts, and I'm here on behalf of Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinics. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. It's a bit unconventional for a medical network of medical clinics to speak at a transportation committee, but I felt it was important to share with you some of the challenges that our patients face because of transportation issues. Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinic is a not-for-profit system of community health centers. We operate five health centers in Hermiston, in Portland, in Woodburn, and in Salem. I have the privilege of representing our behavioral health clinicians in each one of those clinics, and so I had an opportunity to speak to our behavioral health consultants because they get to hear a lot about the challenges that our patients face. So, for example, in our Portland clinic, we're on Southeast Powell, which has been spoken of quite a bit already this evening, and that clinic is lucky enough to be on a TriMet line. TriMet estimates that 42% of weekday rides are taken by low-income riders at or below the 150% poverty level, and that is the predominant population which our clinics serve. Some of the challenges that our patients at the Portland Clinic have faced when they have insurance and they have rides that they can get through their insurance, the ride will show up an hour late and they miss their appointment. And then they're put on an alternate schedule sometimes, or they get in trouble, is what they say, at the clinic because they no-showed. But it wasn't their fault. It was that their transportation just didn't show up, or it was so late they couldn't make their appointment. When they are able to make their appointments, we've also had patients who've had to stay at the clinic for up to 2 hours waiting for their ride to pick them up to take them home. In addition, as many people have talked about, we are on a very busy corridor, and we oftentimes have patients who are anxious when they get to the clinic, so they end up talking to me because they've had a near miss trying to get to the clinic. A similar story can be told about our Woodburn Clinic, which is located on Mount Hood Avenue, where we do have a light for crosswalk, but it doesn't help our patients who are trying to turn left to get into our clinic, and we have quite a few accidents. The Woodburn Police Chief, Alexander, he informed us that there were 29 crashes in that period of roadway just this year, and I can't tell you how many times I've seen patients who are traumatized because they've just had a car accident, and luckily I'm able to see them right away, but it's still very stressful. The other challenge that our Woodburn patients have is that transportation to get to specialty care in Salem or in Portland can take over an hour, and if they do have medical transport, they're only allowed one passenger, which means a parent who has many children won't be able to take their children with them, so they also have child care problems. In Hermiston, they have no public transportation at this point. I did hear today that in January they'll be getting public transportation, but the nearest bus stop to our clinic is a 30-minute walk. So those are some examples. I thank you for the opportunity to advocate for my patients this evening.
Thank you for being here.
Madam Mayor?
Yes. Yes, Senator
Before
Johnson.
This witness leaves, whose rule is it that there can only be one passenger in the ride?
That's the rule set by the transit companies that we work with.
So those are individual transit districts that are making that decision?
Each of the CCOs has a company that they partner with, and the companies each have this rule. They can't. There is a way for the provider, the doctor or the provider, to petition if there is a need, but in general, they're only allowed one passenger.
Well, if that's a local administrative rule, it seems to me that that could be changed fairly easily. And I don't know whether there are federal strictures overlaid on top of that, but that strikes me as something that could be looked at and remediated fairly easily. That's a silly rule.
That would be wonderful.
Representative Smith, is this something that you are familiar with?
It's not, Madam Chair.
It's not. Okay, thank you.
I will say that I've heard very good things about the public transit or the medical transit in Hermiston.
Sorry.
They are good. Yeah.
Would you mind researching that and perhaps getting the information back to our professional staff so that they could disseminate it among the committee? That begs some remediation.
Absolutely. I'm happy to.
Madam Chair, would you check to make certain, you mentioned the word CCO, so
yes.
That tells me there's two pieces to this.
That's
so
right.
Would you check both whether or not it is the CCO and or the transit or maybe both?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hello. Greetings, Madam Chairman and all the members of the committee. My name is Mary Ann Byrne, and I live here in Salem. Before living in Salem, I lived in Seattle, so I know what traffic looks like. The other thing I want to point out is that I'm here to speak against the Salem River crossing that has been going on for years and costing millions of dollars, and the actual something that Mr. Travis talked about earlier about revenue sources. Back in December of 2014, the consultants had us do a financial workshop. And I went to both the daytime one with all the government officials and the evening one with the public. It was interesting to see how the consultants were able to lead all the government officials to do whatever they wanted them to do and to play their computer games so that they could make everything balance out and raise the right number to make the money to pay for it. In the evening, when the public was there, many of the people who participated in this computer model, putting numbers in to try to raise a certain amount of money, well, the numbers had to do with property taxes and fees and registration fees and gas taxes to be added locally and regionally. And the public was actually walking out of that workshop saying, "They can't. There's no way we're going to pay for this, and this is a waste of our time to even sit here and play this game." And they were pissed and they walked out. So I think it also shows that, as was pointed out by Mr. Travis, that people don't want to pay for some of these kind of things. And so since, from my experience with traffic in Seattle, and the reality is as Salem has grown, and many of you drive around Salem, the traffic is showing up at 17th and Center, at Hawthorne and Sunnyview, on Lancaster and Market, 25th and Mission. There's traffic all over the city. If we're only going to focus on the bridge, then we're basically very narrowly sighted. I think you folks can save a whole lot of money if you would stop funding this bridge. The other thing I'd like to point out is that you're already seeing on I-5 by Aurora and Donald that the trucking industry is already building up a very large truck stop, because they already know that they're going to turn off of I-5 there and head for the Newburgh-Dundee bypass and take that route. So the thing is that if folks were thinking that by putting money into the Salem Bridge they were going to be saving money, they're going to be facilitating freight transportation and reducing traffic, the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, which is already under construction and funded, is already going to take a whole lot of traffic out of there. So the need for the bridge is only there because the Chamber of Commerce wants it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question? Yes, Senator Johnson.
I have two questions. Based on your bad experience in Seattle, are there any transportation projects you'd be willing to pay for?
Well, of course, I've been enjoying, whenever I go to Portland, taking the MAX and being able to get around the city very easily that way.
We're talking about your community.
Oh, here in Salem? Well, one of the things, of course, is that we did have a ballot measure to increase funding by charging the business in the area to fund the transit. But the Chamber of Commerce and the businesses basically spent lots of money and shot it down. But the buses don't run then on the weekends.
That didn't answer my question. I was asking what you'd be willing to pay for. My second question is your home or business near the third bridge or affected by it in any way?
All right. My home can be sort of along the edges in that the traffic coming through from the bridge along Pine Street in Cherry coming into Sunnyview to head to I-5 on Market Street. I already have people coming down my 25-mile-an-hour road at 50 miles an hour, and they would also be coming from that area to head to I-5 and could be coming, increasing traffic in my own neighborhood, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, panel. I believe we have one more witness. Sally Cook, please. Welcome. Last but not least, certainly.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for being here. I know this has been a long day, so my goal is to keep this testimony as quick as I can. Thank you. As you know, the next generation is the first generation to have a shorter lifespan.
Sorry, for the record, your name, please.
Oh, yes. I'm Sally Cook, and I'm a resident of Salem.
Thank you.
So this next generation is the first generation to have a shorter lifespan as a result of chronic disease. I'm here tonight because all of us are pedestrian by design, whether or not we're in a car, walking, biking. Humans by nature are pedestrians. In my neighborhood, when I've been out talking with people, the number one complaints that I've heard are about traffic, whether or not it involves speeds, no sidewalks, which they're paying for in front of their house, or congestion when they're driving. I'm here tonight not because I have answers, but just to urge you to take a comprehensive view. I feel that a lot of problems that we have as a result of our transportation are because of a piecemeal approach, because of looking at one situation and trying to solve a problem and creating another. I urge the transportation panel tonight to take a comprehensive view that all road users, not just cars, but bikes, pedestrians, freight, even animals, have access to these public streets, and that any delay on action can, of course, cause more congestion, be dangerous, and be costly. I know that we're in a time where there's no money to fund anything, but I want to encourage the panel that scarcity breeds innovation. And we're at a time when Oregon can lead, where we can have safety for students walking to school, for seniors getting to places of activity, and for families to thrive. Thank you for your work.
Very nice way to wrap up our hearing. Thank you very much, Ms. Cook. Any comments for the good of the order this evening? Thank you all for being here this evening. Oh, yes.
You know, really quick, just
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. It's really interesting, as we've been touring around, how few people have talked about tolling as an option to pay. Mm-hmm. Just
that's
as an observation.
Because the user has to pay.
That's because nobody wants to pay.
That's because nobody wants to pay.
There you go. Nice. Thank you, Representative Smith, for bringing that forward. It's a topic we will revisit, I'm sure. We are adjourned.